Natural Solutions with Dr. J, your source for time-tested and cutting-edge natural medicine approaches to optimize your health, with your host, Dr. J. Sordian.
So, this is Dr. J. Sordian on Natural Solutions with Dr. J, and I am so pleased today to have the opportunity to share with our audience the wisdom and the experience of Tina Greenbaum.
Hi there.
Hi there. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
So we met not too long ago at a mixer, and you moved to California recently.
I did. It's actually 3 years, but it still feels very new because there's
years,
so much
more.
Yes.
So you're based in California now, and you were in New York.
Yes, I was.
And so tell me a little bit something. You are, you have a program called Mastery Under Pressure.
Yes.
And you're also California's number one optimal performance specialist. Now, give us a little bit of background about how you got to that point, and then please give me some idea about the kinds of examples of the kinds of people that you have been able to help so well.
Okay. So Mastery Under Pressure, this is a way that I have put a lot of my work together into one package. So I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I've been doing this work for over 34 years.
Fantastic.
And I started on an eating disorders unit in Washington, D.C., and it was one of the first eating disorders units in the country, and nobody knew how to treat eating disorders. And so they gave us beginning therapists a manual that said alcoholism, and then they crossed that out and put eating disorders. And then they said, go.
That's so fascinating. And so originally there wasn't a lot of information about how to address eating disorders. And so they had a manual on alcoholism, and they just said,
correct,
okay, adapt it.
Correct. Correct. And if anybody knows anything about the denial in alcoholism, which is, you know, really kind of well known of how long you can be an alcoholic, eating disorders is 10 times worse.
Is that as far as the denial side of it, or?
Yes, denial system. Yeah, there's a tremendous, tremendous denial system. There's a lot of distortion. There's a lot of body distortion. So you might look at somebody who you know is so painfully thin, and they think that they're fat. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the brain that's telling them that. And at the same time, it's a very, very difficult challenge to break through that.
So is this like a lot of self-talk inside that's saying that they aren't thin enough or something?
Yeah, well, there's that. It's complicated. It's a really complicated disorder.
Uh-huh.
Because many women who have, let's say, anorexia or bulimia, they may also be drug addicts. They also may be sex addicts. They may be depressed. They may be highly anxious. Well, they're definitely highly anxious. There's not even a question, because in my belief, all addictions are anxiety-based. So, you know, there's borderline personality. There's bipolar disorder in there. There's just about everything that we need to sort out and kind of tease out, I like to say, so we can see really kind of what's going on. But it's basically an issue of control.
Interesting. So if somebody comes into a eating disorders program, and I know that's not the focus of this particular program, but it's fascinating to me to see how you've gotten to where you are and all the insight that you have based on, you know, your clinical experience. So when someone comes into an eating disorders clinic, the professional will be trying to sort out which of these or which of the several combinations of those types of issues are going on that are underlying the eating disorder?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I was just talking to a client this morning who doesn't have an eating disorder. She has something else that's going on. But, you know, we call them dual diagnoses. There's more than one thing going on.
Uh-huh.
And so...
Can it be more than two?
Can be.
It's just too complicated to deal with it.
Yeah, to go back to your question, though, about how I got to where I am from that.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I tell the story a lot of times, I like to be successful. And I was not being successful with these young women. They were very, very smart, very creative. They could catch on pretty quickly about insight. You know, my mother, my father, my sister, my brother, you know, all these things. They could figure out, like, maybe how I got here. But they couldn't change. They didn't know how to change. And so as a change agent, that was my job, is how do I help somebody to change? And so I got my first clue at a yoga class. And
was that at the eating disorders clinic?
Or? Yes, that was at the same time. I had never taken a yoga class before, and I got into this deep state of relaxation at the end of the class where they put you into the posture Shavasana, or corpse pose.
Okay.
And I got into this unbelievable state of relaxation that I had never, ever, ever experienced before. And I said, wow, if I could only get those girls to do this, maybe they wouldn't need the eating disorder. And so that was my introduction to sort of mind-body. Now, again, there's a lot more information out now. There's a lot of neuroscience. There's all kinds of things that I didn't have, you know, 30-some years ago.
Exactly.
I just had my nose.
Yes.
You know, just sort of following my intuition. And that, and they would talk to me, and I'd said, I hear you, but I don't feel you. I'm not getting you, you know. And so as I'm, you know, you can't see me sitting here, but I'm sort of pointing to my heart. It's like, I'm not feeling you. I'm not catching you. And so, again, I intuitively knew that that's where change had to happen, because we had to get into the feelings.
So,
and
they were too much into their head.
Exactly, which is very typical, not only of women with eating disorders. It's very typical of our culture.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's typical.
We're like walking heads.
that's what I am, too, yeah. So I always like, this is a great conversation.
Right. And so it just started to, I started to really kind of follow that question, how do I help somebody change at a fundamental level? So we have our mind, body, spirit, and emotion. These are the four quadrants that make up a holistic picture, a whole person. And so I went along and really kind of looked at each one of these quadrants and understanding how they're intimately connected, but I also knew that I needed to get under the conscious mind in order for change to happen. So that took me on a journey of a lot of different trainings and things to do with trauma and EMDR, which is called eye movement desensitization reprocessing, which is a trauma kind of strategy, working with the eyes. And there's just a lot of things now that are out there, and the way that they're training therapists now is very different than the way that I was trained. I'd love to be going to school now again.
Well, you grew up in an era as so many new ideas and technologies have been developed, and so you feel like it would have been great if they were already had existed.
Well, you know, the truth is, yeah, it would have been a shortcut for me, but now they have names for things that I already know.
Uh-huh.
So they call it bottom-up therapy instead of top-down. So in other words, body, using the body, coming up from the body into the mind, as opposed to the mind going down into the body, which is the way traditional psychotherapy
was, and still is for many
people.
So when you say from up to down or down to up, because I'm sort of spatially oriented, does the up to down and the down to up refer to the actual physical body and like the brain or the mental processes, or is it considered that mental processes are more like just physically higher up and then bodily processes are lower down, or in the quadrant system, is there some spatiality?
I think it's the first thing, Jay, you know, it's really kind of the brain.
Yeah.
You know, and how the brain and the body are connected. So that if we get, let's say that we're afraid of dogs. I always use this example. Let's say I had a terrible experience with dogs when I was a child. And
sorry,
my peripheral vision picks up a dog.
Ah.
Right?
Yep.
And my body is going to respond.
Uh-huh.
That's going to hit that part of the brain, right, where the trauma sits.
Uh-huh.
Not the logical part.
That makes sense.
Right? Right? Yep. So in my work, it's really about how do I get to that place? How do I get to the place to assist so that the body doesn't respond so quickly?
I see. All right. So that is, that's kind of an example or a crux or a, it's like our typical example of if you're working with someone, when you're working with somebody, that is what you're looking for to figure out where, what the underlying issue might be that's creating the physical response.
Right. That's one. That's right. Yeah. And then going after it.
Right. Right. Okay.
Right, because we could talk about it and we could know it, but that doesn't change it.
True.
Necessarily. Sometimes it does.
Yeah.
Many times it doesn't.
And it doesn't change it because it's an ingrained pattern, a neurological pattern that, that just fires off so quickly it's very difficult to alter it unless you know what you're doing and using some processes to alter that. Yeah.
Exactly. And so what I like to teach people is I like to teach that people how to do that for themselves. I mean, ultimately, you know.
How
so
to do I'm, what?
How to change those systems so they don't fire so quickly.
I see. So it's both recognizing what's the trigger and then also knowing how to alter it?
Exactly.
Fascinating. So what kind of approach, for it, for example, in that situation with the fear of the dog, and then maybe stiffening up of the body or some kind of a immediate stress response, adrenaline rushing through your system or something like that. Give me an example of some of the approaches that you use to alter that.
Okay, so the first thing that we have to do.
Okay.
So so let's just say the dog comes into the peripheral. We're going to do this like not when there's a dog around.
Yes, exactly.
So we're going to just sort of imagine that there's a dog around. And we're going to we're going to start to notice. Everything is about noticing.
Okay.
Raising your level of awareness. This is, you know, again, now it's called, you know, with mindfulness is a really, really, really big thing, you know, today.
That's right.
But mindfulness is simply being aware of what is going on in the moment.
Got it.
Right. So we begin to start to watch and notice. And notice what's happening. Like, where does it hit you in the body? You know, what kind of thoughts come up? What kind of and the more you focus your attention and your intention, you begin to sort of awaken the memory. You awaken the cells. You awaken. You know, you're more of the brain. You know, person than I am in terms of the real fine tuning of it. But basically, it begins to start. It starts to reverberate energetically, and it you begin to start I remember that, or yeah, that makes perfectly sense to me. So we get into another part of our system that we don't typically have access to just by sitting, watching, noticing, and not running away.
So it sounds sort of like a dissection of a memory, at least in that example. That wasn't there before. That it's revealing itself. The layers are peeling away, and you go, oh, what's that?
Exactly.
Oh, I didn't.
Exactly. So it's actually getting into the unconscious in a very kind of non-invasive way. Now, again, if there's a real trauma, sometimes people just feel kind of nothing, like nothing. Like, I don't feel anything, I don't see anything, there's nothing happening. That's one, you know, there are many different things that might show up. And I can never, ever, ever predict what is going to be. All I can do is be there with that person and sort of be a witness. Because sometimes, you know, I had somebody that I was doing this eye movement stuff with.
The rapid eye movement, EMDR.
Right, because she couldn't get herself to exercise. I said, okay, so we'll start with what happens when you think about exercising, and she's just sitting there, and you know, she's just kind of noticing what comes up for her, and then all of a sudden she just goes into this unbelievable, we call it ab reaction, you know, just like crying and scared, and I'm just sitting with her, and turns out she had been horribly, horribly abused, sexually abused as a child, like a child slave, you know.
Oh, my God.
And she felt like a leper. I mean, it was severe, really severe.
And this was something that she had not ever remembered until then, or she just...
I think she had some memory, but I don't think she was in touch with the terror.
Right.
I mean, she just, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so... Again, this was early when I started doing EMDR, and I said, Tina, you think you're good? Let's see how good you really are, because she was really, but I understood that these are memories, right? So it wasn't happening in the present.
Obviously
and so,
not, yeah.
Right, so what I just needed to do with her was to give her that safe space so that she could, I always think of emotion or memories or, you know, feeling like an arc. It's like a bridge. You know, the stuff starts and then we might get very anxious and we typically run away. We typically bury it. And then it just re-energizes. And so if somebody's willing and I can sit with them, you know, we kind of start and then we don't run away. We just sort of notice. And if sometimes the anxiety reaches a peak and then it begins to dissipate. And so we want to get to the other side. So, and that's kind of what I did with her. Just kind of took her to the other side and it neutralized a lot of the terror.
And it neutralized because there was this discharge of the memory or the emotion attached to the memory, so it could get out, and then it no longer had to be held somewhere.
Exactly. So this is like my background. You know?
All right. Okay.
In terms of sitting with people for, you know, really, I don't know, hundreds, maybe thousand people, you know, over the 30 some years, and really understanding how we're kind of put together.
Uh huh.
Without all the fancy names and without the brain scans. And I mean, that stuff is really great. But it's really understanding over time how we've got our mental side and we've got our emotional side, and they're two very different, they're two different processes. And many times we try to solve a lot of emotional problems with logic. And then we wonder why it's, you know, nothing's changing.
Uh-huh.
You know, like so, I had somebody who was an accountant who wanted to do public speaking, and she said, I know, I practice, and then I get up there, my heart is racing so hard, I can't stop it. Well, that's because she doesn't have the right tool to learn how to stop it.
Very interesting.
So that she can speak more clearly, right.
And so that's an example of someone who came to you who wanted to go out and do more public speaking, but it was just so terrifying that she'd get out there and she would freeze.
Right. And, you know, and again, when people don't do things, a lot of times, again, they avoid. They just don't do it. But I'm always really interested in the how come. What is it that when you attempt to go do this, what happens? So for her, she was a very shy person, and she, you know, it was not easy for her. For somebody else, they might have had a terrible experience. For somebody else, it might have been something else. So if we don't take the time to take a look, we're just kind of operating in the dark.
Yeah.
So I'm a real big fan of clarity.
So would you say that shyness is like a personality trait or something that people have a characteristic of being shy and they can get over it, or is it always from some trauma or something else?
It doesn't have to be. No, it could be anything. I mean, one of my sons is very shy, and he's an introvert, and he'll never really love being extroverted and out there and, you know, a party person and a...
Right.
It's not his thing. It actually makes him very tired and exhausted, so he can do it in small pieces or like, you know... whereas my middle son is much more of a party animal kind of person.
Uh-huh.
And so, and he asked me, when he was just like 5 or 6 years old, he says, will I ever get over being shy? And, you know, to a degree, absolutely yes. Absolutely. As you grow and gain more tools and more self-knowledge. But, you know, he'll always be that introvert.
Yeah. So would you say introverts and extroverts in general are sort of, they're sort of hardwired to a degree?
I do believe.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think as we grow and become more evolved, we get more sort of in the middle.
Yes.
You know, we want to be able to have both axes, but we'll always have a tendency to be one or the other.
That makes sense. So the quadrants you talk about. So when you're working with, you've worked with actors and singers and CEOs and in situations where they know that they need help, they aren't where they want to be. How do you use this quadrant thing? Do you as you're going through your process, do you say, okay, they're more in this quadrant than that quadrant, or, and then you said,
well,
something.
Kind of what I start with, and I've done this my whole career, whether whomever I'm working with. One of the things that I found a lot is people would come to me from other therapists or self-help books or all kinds of courses, and they would know a lot, but they wouldn't know how, they didn't have tools. You know, so it's the same thing. It's like if I want to get up there and speak and I know it makes me anxious, other than avoiding it, what can I do? You know, what are the things that I can do? So I start out with the skills that help to quiet down the left side of the brain, help to quiet down the chatter side. And so as we quiet that part down, the right side begins to open, and this is where our creativity is. It's a very different process. So when you're performing at your optimal best, you're not thinking very much. You're really sort of in the zone where you have practiced something over and over and over again, and you have the knowledge and the practice that you're able to focus on this only the things that are going to bring you a high performance. Does that make sense?
Very interesting. I always kind of fall back on the analogy of learning to drive a car.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there's a certain skill set, you know, pressing the accelerator, the brake, taking your foot back and forth, the different ones, and being aware of what's going on. And hopefully it gets ingrained at such a deep level that as you're driving along and you aren't thinking about anything besides maybe the next meal you're going to have or the book that you read,
right,
or you're engaged in a conversation, your foot goes off the accelerator and slams on the brake when in your periphery you see this thing happening.
That's right.
And so it's kind of like having that expertise so that you can be spontaneous and you can respond. I mean, it's a little different from being a singer, an actor, but that's kind of an analogy that I like to use.
Right. Okay, so again, you build those neural pathways, and they kind of go underground, and they operate for you,
yes,
so to speak. Right?
So that's that more like at the unconscious level.
That's right. That's right. So we have to be able to program our unconscious with the kinds of things that are going to give us the best performance. And again, untrained, the unconscious will, you know, it'll protect us. It'll do all kinds of things, so we don't feel pain. So we, you know, and then we tend to, you know, we can avoid things, and we don't ever seem to really reach that potential that we have, because every time that we're reaching for a new level, we're going to be uncomfortable.
Yeah,
we're just going to be uncomfortable.
And that doesn't matter whether you're extrovert, introvert, or anything.
Nothing. Okay. When you're stepping out of your comfort zone of what is familiar and what is regular and what is typical, every time we step into something, it may be very exciting. Okay.
Yeah.
Fear and excitement are flip sides of the same emotion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But we're not going to best be neutral. Okay. So there's something that's going to go on. And in order to be able to tolerate that new level, we have to have these skills. That's my opinion.
Very interesting. So it's the skills that you're talking about that you're able to teach people, whether in a one-on-one session, or you also have like group sessions and programs.
Yes. So I have a group program, and again, I call it Mastery Under Pressure.
Uh-huh.
And what I teach is I teach focus, relaxation, dealing with negative self-talk, visualization, and dealing with fear. That's my curriculum.
That sounds like quite a menu.
It is quite a menu. Yeah. And it's a 6-month program, which is why it's 6 months, because it takes time to integrate. You know, I could teach content very easily. What we're talking about is content, you know. It's really kind of push, and once we learn the content, then what I call it's kind of a long haul. It's the behavior change.
Uh-huh.
It's giving yourself permission to be very, very mindful and to constantly make corrections and doing it in a non-judgmental way so that you can actually move forward. Because once you start judging yourself and getting mad at yourself, then you're going down another path, which
yeah,
then
so
takes
the,
you...
So, yeah, the statement that you make, giving yourself permission to be mindful. I haven't heard anything described in that way before, and so it's very that's very, very interesting. I mean, there's so many classes about mindfulness and things like that. It almost sounds like the body doesn't, or some aspect may not want to allow it to be mindful. It's like giving
it's work.
Yeah,
it's work.
Okay.
You know. I consider this work, I call it the work of the warrior.
Uh-huh.
Because there has to be a willingness to face the things that we typically don't want to face. And the process of transformation, really, which is what we're really talking about, is the process of transformation is not an easy path. And it's not for everybody. I mean, it could be for everybody if everybody had the willingness to do it, but it's not for everybody. It takes courage.
Yeah.
You know, it takes courage to say, hey, you know, I screwed up. I'm not really happy with what I'm doing, or I'm not happy with where I am. And how am I responsible for that? How did I get myself here? You know, what do I need to do?
Yeah, I think there's certainly plenty of people, I mean, I do it myself too, complain about their situation and say, oh, I just really don't like this. This really sucks or whatever. And yet that is just step one.
That's right. I just wrote a blog, and I just did a little Facebook Live today on five ways that you can begin to start to change your life, five immediate ways that you can begin to start to change your life. And number one is to acknowledge that you have a problem.
Yeah.
You know? And number two is that you created the problem. Willingly or unwillingly, you've had a part in it.
Okay, you had a part in it. It may not be just totally you, but at least you had a part in it.
Exactly.
Okay.
You know, I had breast cancer, right?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so people get really stuck in, oh, how did I create this? And, you know, no, but I had a part in it in terms of where my life was and what was happening to me, that energetically, you know, all those things that I didn't deal with, they came to haunt me.
Right.
You know, I have no question in my mind, you know, that the stress and not living who I am had a lot to do with my breast cancer. Okay, and whatever else was going on that was just totally out of my control.
There you go.
I don't know.
Yeah,
the food,
I think that's good to say that I have at least partial responsibility. I mean, that's so much easier for most people to, like, to grok or to, you know, accept and say, okay, yeah, I'll accept some responsibility, but to accept total responsibility, sometimes that it just seems like, I don't know, am I totally responsible for everything?
Well, but the point is, Jay, is like what we do so many things unconsciously.
That's also true.
That's the bottom, you know, the unconscious is very wise.
Yeah.
And we do things. I had a teacher said one time that all behavior has a positive intent. All behavior has a positive intent. So if we look at the terrorists and the most horrible things, for that particular person, there is some positive intent for them.
Right.
Whatever it is, you know, I'm going to get to Allah. I'm going to get to this. I'm going to, you know, there is some way that the psyche has played around with it.
Yeah.
To make it acceptable to that particular person.
Right, right.
Nobody goes out and says, I'm this mean, horrible person. That's not the intention.
Probably, yeah. Probably.
Maybe they're, you know, but... So maybe our psyches are very complicated.
Uh-huh.
So we're given things, and we the way that we're raised, and I mean, all kinds of things that influence us.
Yeah.
And the stuff goes underground.
Yeah.
It just goes underground.
So that was step number two.
So accept that you have acknowledge you have a problem, you've created it, and then you begin to start to, again, the mindfulness comes in. What are the thoughts? What are my thoughts? What are my feelings that are associated with this? You know, what's it connected to? What's mine? What's not mine? Just like, you know, what am I willing to accept responsibility for? Let's say that we're in a job that we're not happy with. All right, well, somehow or other, I got myself here. I accepted this job.
Yeah.
You know, and I may have, you know, again, I have a client that signed on to something that looked absolutely fabulous. Turned out it wasn't so fabulous. You know, her bosses were a bit misogynist, and you know, she was a very strong woman that couldn't be sort of manipulated, and she got fired.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So we start looking at what's your part? How did you get yourself here? And what's not? You know, so we begin to start to, because the goal is to problem solve.
Interesting.
That's mm-hmm. my, you know, that's the, so we can't problem solve if we don't know where we are. We don't know. So, again, I have this incredible, ridiculous willingness to go to these fine places, you know, just as if I were a surgeon, to really kind of pull out what's true, you know, what's really going on here. So we start to notice and we start to, you know, kind of put things together, and we start to have some idea how I got myself here. And then you ask yourself, what's in my control and what's out of my control? Now that I know I got myself here and I want to move forward, what am I in charge of? You know, again, if I have a miserable boss, I don't know. You know, is there any room there to be proactive and to stay in the job and gather other resources to help you and so on? Or is there not? What's in my control? What's out of my control? That's my central question for everything. Because when we think about stress, stress is, in the definition that I've used and that I've learned to use, and it's held through for all these years, stress is the perceived amount of control that we think we have or we don't have.
Interesting.
Perceived.
Uh-huh.
But there's some things, again, like earthquakes, and we don't have a whole lot of control. We're in a plane, we don't have a whole lot of control. We have control whether we put ourselves on the plane, but we, you know, once we've given away that, you know, that role, we don't have a whole lot of control. We have control about how we breathe, how we talk to ourselves, and all that kind of stuff. But so every time you're in a situation where you're feeling like you're up against the wall, what's in my control? What's out of my control? That's the central question. And then the fifth thing is you got to be brutally honest with yourself. Brutally honest, as best you can, because, again, the unconscious is very tricky. Sometimes it tries to fool us, and we miss things, but brutally honest. What's the truth? So if I'm trying to get myself out of a situation or trying to figure it out, it's like, all right, Tina, what is the truth here? You know, what decisions did you make? How did you get yourself here? What did you miss? All these kinds of things. And then as you begin to start to recognize that kind of stuff, then you can make choices about how to move forward.
Very interesting. So this was, you just today did a Facebook Live event?
Yes.
With these five different steps, did you call them?
Yes, yes. And then there's a blog on my Mastery Under Pressure community. I'm starting a new group and hoping to get as many people on it and asking questions and talking about this stuff and asking, you know, things that they want me to write about or talk about or questions that they have. Or
Is a new Facebook group that you have created.
Correct.
So the listening audience would be able to join that group?
Absolutely.
All right.
Be my guest. Yeah.
So what were the details if they wanted to join that?
They just have to go to it, and it's a public group. It's not a private group. So you just go and you join.
It's called Mastery Under Pressure?
Community. Mastery Under Pressure Community.
Community. All right. And then your Facebook is also Mastery Under Pressure?
Yes. And then it's also under my name, Tina Greenbaum.
It's spelled out for the listening audience, not everyone.
It's T-I-N-A, that's my first name. And Greenbaum is G-R-E-E-N, like the color. B as in boy, A-U-M as in Mary.
.com.
Right. So you can go to my website. There's all kinds of information. And then I have a workshop coming up October 21st here in Emeryville, California. Pardon?
It's a month away. And what did you say after that?
No, it's in Emeryville, California, right in the East Bay.
All right.
Right? And it's a one-day training. And I go through each one of these steps, focus, relaxation, dealing with negative self-talk, visualization, dealing with fear. And I have a guest speaker at the end of the day who's a master business coach. And when we talk a lot about how we put this into the workplace, you know, stress in the workplace and how to elevate your performance. I mean, that's what, so I really want to differentiate the fact that we started out talking about with women with eating disorders and people coming to therapy. This is really, I call myself a coachy therapist. So it's for wellness. It's for actually elevating your performance, feeling better and reaching levels that maybe you never thought you could reach before.
It sounds like a fantastic, that's a one day.
It's one day. It's $197 and you can bring a guest.
Wow.
So it's two for one.
Great deal.
Yeah.
So in order for people to learn more about that, they would just go to tinagreenbaum.com and you have the
/programs.
All right. So I think people have your website now, and they also know that they could join your Facebook group, which is Mastery Under Pressure Community.
Right.
What other ways?
They can email me.
They can email you. All right.
At tinagreenbaum.com.
All right. That's pretty straightforward.
Yep. Try to make it simple.
Simple is good. And then your the Facebook Live event that you just did, they just go to your Facebook.
That community page, it'll be on there.
Oh, it'll be there, okay.
And then my intention is every Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock Pacific to put up another one, and then every Tuesday there'll be a blog every Tuesday, and then every Wednesday I'll talk about the blog.
Great. And the blog is on the tinagreenbaum.com.
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, fantastic. I think that you have given us a great deal of help and given some really good direction for where people can go to learn more and get a greater deal of mastery while under pressure. So any last words you would like to give?
Spread the word. Spread the word, because this is my little part of the universe that I think can change the world. And if you know, for my whole entire career, it's really about teaching people how to be extraordinarily mentally healthy and resilient. And God knows we need that today.
We need it from our leaders.
We need it from our parents teaching children. We need it from our teachers. So everybody can use what I have to offer.
Good point. I agree 100%. All part of
the human condition. We're all in it together.
We are in it together, and we need to come up with some solutions to make it a much better place to live, that's for sure.
That's for sure. So just think about what it would look like if everybody took responsibility for their own behavior.
Yeah, that would be something.
Right.
Something really so possible. Easy
to blame, right?
Right. Well, fantastic. Thank you for joining us in this episode of Natural Solutions with Dr. J. And make sure that you get in touch with Tina through her website, Facebook, and elsewhere.
Thank you, and thank you so much for inviting me. It's been
my great pleasure.
All right.
Thank you.
Take care now.
Thank you. You too.
If you're interested in finding out more about how you or your relatives can avoid dementia, buy the book, Outsmarting the Dementia Epidemic, 7 Key Memory Care Actions to Avoid Alzheimer's and Successfully Keep Your Brain Safe, Sharp, and Sexy into the Future, by going to OutsmartingDementia.com. That's OutsmartingDementia.com. If you'd like to learn more about how to get an appointment with Dr. Sorian, please call the Redwood Clinic at 510-849-1176. And for information, go to theredwoodclinic.com. Thank you. If you'd like to be informed of upcoming podcasts, please subscribe to Natural Solutions with Dr. J so you know exactly when the next episodes will be coming up. Thanks a lot and have a great day.